Okay, we are now going to begin. So, good afternoon or morning, depending on your time zone, and welcome to APSA's second interactive session on Research Integrated Postgraduate Medical Training Programs. My name is Avik Banerjee, and I serve as the 2019-2020 President of the American Physician Scientist Association. This meeting is designed as an introduction for prospective applicants and current trainees to a physician scientist training program and research and residency programs, specifically within pediatrics. Recordings and any shared materials from this session will be made available on APSA's website for public accessibility following this meeting. As a bit of housekeeping before we begin, this session will begin with a series of prepared questions and will be followed by an informal Q&A moderated by myself. So individuals in the chat room are encouraged to submit questions to me via the GoToMeeting conference call chat room. So on the very bottom of the GoToMeeting conference call panel, you'll see the chat. So if you can individually send me a message, I will ask these questions in the order received. In the event that the same topic is asked multiple times, I'll try my best to consolidate similar questions together. So in case your specific question is not asked to that effect, please feel free to message me individually and I can try to phrase it more accurately. With that said, we ask that all non-panelists connected to the GoToMeeting please mute your microphones to improve the clarity of the audio recording and communication of the panelists. So with that, it is my pleasure to introduce our keynote panelists. First, very briefly, both the name as well as the institution they represent. So Dr. Parsons from Texas Children's Hospital, Dr. Gonzalez from the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, Dr. Hunstad from the Washington University in St. Louis School of Medicine, Dr. Hogarty from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Ms. Michelle Cooley, the Program Coordinator for the Pediatric Scientist Development Program. Dr. Permar from Duke University School of Medicine will join the call a little bit later. We thank each of you for taking time out of your schedules. We understand you're very busy to talk to current trainees about these different training pathways. So I'm going to begin by opening up with a general question for the entire panel. And to begin, what are some unique features of pursuing a physician scientist career and biomedical research career in pediatrics?
I suppose I can. Hi, this is Fernando Gonzalez at
Great.
UCSF. So, can you hear me okay? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and I'm relatively new to this position, overseeing the physician scientist training program in pediatrics here at UCSF. So, I suppose you mean in contrast to internal medicine or some
Yes.
other similar physician scientist program. So I can't speak necessarily to the other departments. I can speak I know what they do specifically in internal medicine here at UCSF, and so I can compare and contrast. A lot of most of, and I guess this speaks to really what the goals of our training program are here. We're really heavily focused on mentorship and building a community. We have a curriculum and some other things. The issues have been with the resident schedules and getting protected time, and we have protected time, and so I can go through that, but it's relatively limited from what I gather compared to what the internal medicine group has here. They have a block schedule which enables, they call it hot and cold months or even odd months, but the point is they have a lot of dedicated half days and curriculum where the whole group gets together and they do science talks or career and leadership development. And we're, our block schedule isn't built to enable that, and I also gather from speaking to the internal medicine people that their requirements for their residency, as far as the required rotations and the way they build electives allow a lot more flexibility. So our program, while we do have a curriculum and we're built on, talking about, we have seminars built on specific things. A lot of it, like I said, it's really heavily focused on the mentorship and building a community so that when they go to their next steps in their career, which is fellowship, or some sort of postdoc, that they're prepared for that.
Avik, this is David Hunstad. If I'll cobble on to a couple of those comments. So I think for the trainees on the call, it's important to understand that formal physician scientist training programs in medicine have been around longer, if you will, than formal PSTPs in pediatrics. So just as an example, here at WashU, our medicine PSTP was one of the earliest medicine PSTPs in the country. It's been around for something like 20 years. Our PEDS program has been formalized for about 8 years now. So so some of those programs in medicine will have more features that might not be fully developed in pediatrics or might be unique to the sizes of medicine programs, which tend to be larger than pediatric residency programs. They may have a little more schedule flexibility than some PEDS programs, but I think PEDS programs are new enough that there's not necessarily a standard for the kinds of things that Fernando's talking about in terms of protected time. So applicants need to just be asking these questions, you know, when they're looking into that. In terms of the other major sort of feature, I would say that obviously pediatrician scientists are spending their clinical time taking care of kids. And so at some level, that should be the main driver of whether you become an internal medicine physician scientist or a PEDS physician scientist, is what kind of patients do you like taking care of? But it's also important to know that even if you're a pediatrician scientist, your research is more likely to touch child health, but it's definitely not limited to child health. So the full range of research opportunities at most of these pediatric PSTPs are available to you. You're not limited to working, for example, within labs within a department of pediatrics.
Yeah, I think that's this is Mike Hogarty at CHOP. I think that's an excellent summary. And the final point, you know, for a lot of campuses that are unified geographically, like we have here at Penn, a single footprint more or less with the disparate hospitals and programs and universities. And so there's a great sort of momentum to try to harmonize between PEDS and medicine and departments of psychiatry and family medicine and other programs where physician scientists want to move into because it fits their clinical interests best. And so we are learning from each other and trying to sort of get in line to define what works best for trainees, what seems to work for launching them towards success. And for many campuses like that, you know, the open research model, which we adopt here, means that, you know, you could be in the Department of Pediatrics and yet do research in any lab affiliated with our campus, be it in the vet school, medical school, other departments and programs. And that gives you a lot of freedom to find the right setting for both your clinical needs to be met in terms of training and also your research needs to be met.
This is Will Parsons from Texas Children's and Baylor College of Medicine. I think that's a great point. I mean, we take a very flexible approach here in terms of the research opportunities as well, that you know, folks in our PSTP can either work in one of the pediatrics labs and basic science departments. You know, in the Texas Medical Center, there's more than a handful of other institutions, Rice University, MD Anderson, et cetera, and we've had trainees, you know, work at some of those other sites as well. I think pediatrics and pediatric scientists, it's a smaller, kind of tighter community, and some flexibility is sometimes required in terms of matching up ideal research kind of interest and focus along with your clinical expertise.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. To our second question, and also as kind of for general announcement for housekeeping, please, if you have individual questions that you would like to add, please feel free to message me and I'll add them down. So thank you, Rhea, for the question. I'll add that to our future opened Q&A. The next question I wanted to ask is actually going to the comment about pediatric scientist training programs and research and residency programs being relatively younger than internal medicine. How are these programs typically organized? And what's the, like, for a trainee trainee at MS3 going to MS4, what exactly, is there a categorical difference or an agreed upon definition of a research and residency program versus a pediatric scientist training program? How are they organized?
This is Mike Hogarty again. I'm going to take the second part first, the pediatric physician scientist program part, because that's the part that I'm much clearer on. Here we have everybody apply categorical. We don't have any sort of separate matchable slots or quotas on physician scientists within our group of interns. We value physician scientist contributions greatly, but we also value other areas of excellence that people demonstrate during their medical school training. We capture typically anywhere from 15 to 20% of our interns will be MD, PhDs, and we would consider them physician scientists, but we don't require them to have a PhD. We also call out people with 2 years of full-time dedicated research with first author publication and treat them similarly. So not quite the same depth and breadth of research experience, but at least some demonstrated excellence and interest in that area. And we invite them to campus on one of a handful of days, which aren't purely dedicated to physician scientists, but they are enriched for physician scientists on those days. And we give them the exact same interview day that everybody gets, from about early morning till 2 p.m., because we don't want them to be feeling like they're put in a different box in terms of their interest in looking at the residency program in its entirety. But then we embellish that with science meetings the rest of that afternoon, a dinner with our physician scientist trainees in the residency and the fellowships that evening, and if their travel allows, meetings the next morning after our grand rounds. And we're a pathway agnostic program, which means I've seen subtle hints maybe that others might believe a pathway is more likely to lead to success. I don't necessarily believe that. I think individuals may gravitate towards a particular pathway as suiting their own personal needs best. And so we're supportive of all of the accelerated pathways, ARP or IRP, but we're also supportive of people who want to do categorical 3-year training. I don't think that means you're not serious about your science. And if you want to accelerate, I don't think it means you're not serious about your clinical skill set. I think it's just you're doing what we've asked, which is to think long and hard about how you want to build your career, and we'll help advise you towards that.
Now, this is David again. I'll follow up on a couple of Mike's points. So, you know, I think there's, to get to the one of the questions that was asked, there's not a sort of a fixed set of guidelines about how these things are precisely organized at different institutions, but I think they're very similar. So listening to Mike talk about how things work at CHOP in terms of the application process, interview process, we also have a single, you know, categorical match. Some places do have a separate NRMP program number for their, quote, research track residents. So there's, you'll find a mix, I think, of those things out there. Many places will support the defined residency pathways that the ABP has outlined, which Mike mentioned, the accelerated research pathway and the integrated research pathway. The accelerated research pathway, as opposed to a typical 3-year residency followed by a 3-year fellowship, essentially consists of a 2-year pediatric residency followed by 4 years of fellowship, so that by the end of year 6, you've gotten an additional year during that fellowship, that prolonged fellowship period, to get protected research time in, and you essentially have 3 lab years done in most subspecialties by the time you're done with year 6, as opposed to 2 years if you're a typical categorical resident followed by a typical fellow. Integrated research pathway involves getting some research months done earlier and not pushing the research time all the way off to fellowship period. That, I think, is much less common, mostly because you really have to pick a research project that is well suited to that kind of a schedule of having research time. And Sally Permar, when she comes on the call, can talk about this more, but she's been very active in developing proposals for more research in residency programs, where you would actually take a whole year, like early in residency, and do things. They actually have a proposal out to the ABP to create yet another sort of defined pathway that combines research and clinical training. So these things are all out there. There'll be some minor variation at different institutions in terms of exactly how they work it. But those general features that Mike and I just outlined, I think people will find at many programs.
Right. So this is Will. I think that's right. So, for example, our standard here at Baylor College of Medicine is actually the structures built around the integrated research pathway, with the idea that having that early research experience and exposure can allow people to get started on kind of planning and strategizing projects and timelines and such that'll continue into the fellowship years. So we do also have people who do the ARP and the other variants, but the kind of curriculum we've built in terms of some of the mentoring and some of the, you know, training and grant preparation and that sort of stuff is based upon most of our trainees being in the integrated research pathway. And we do have separate dedicated match slots for residents in that pathway, but then also the capacity to actually go beyond that and have residents who are matched to the categorical system who can still follow some of the same curricula and that sort of thing. So there's definitely a number of different approaches to the specifics of the organization and structure of this at different pediatric institutions.
Thank you. One of the comments that was made earlier was regarding research time. So I know there's a great deal of variability in terms of when research time is kind of integrated into the overall pathway. But one question trainees have are, how exactly is research time protected in these overall two different types of programs, or like in pediatrician scientist training programs and research and residency? Do individuals have to balance clinical responsibilities at the same time, or is there flexibility as to scheduling?
So this is Will. So I'm not really that familiar with the research and residency program, so someone else will have to comment on that. But in terms of the PSPs, for example, our program essentially has a month of protected time first year, a month of protected time second year, and then 10 months as a block of protected time third year, which is almost entirely protected from any clinical responsibilities except for, I don't know, a couple of calls scattered across that whole year, basically. So it's actually, in our program, and I suspect that at a decent number of others, it's a quite uniquely protected time that's frankly unlike anything that will be experienced after that point, either in fellowship or as a faculty member. So it's ideally, even though it's not much time, it's a pretty tightly protected time.
Okay. Related to the question of structure and research time, there was a comment about actually integrating fellowship training immediately following residency, formal completion of residency. And at least when we've heard in our medicine interactive session, we've heard about integrated programs whereby fellowship and participating of cell specialties are facilitated. I wanted to ask if there are similar integrated approaches in different pediatrician scientist training programs whereby fellowships and participating departments are facilitated by the administration there.
So
what do you mean by facilitated exactly? I'm sorry.
To clarify, applicants within the residencies are put into contact with fellowship directors or department chairs to at least within the application process. I don't want to say, I'm trying to avoid the term guaranteed fellowship, but I'm trying to like at least imply that there are efforts from the residency programs to at least help promote continuity of training at the same institution.
This is David. So I think, you know, the issues you're talking about are really important. I think, yes, you want to avoid using the word guaranteed for various reasons, both sort of logistical and obviously from a regulatory standpoint, there may be some issues with, quote, guaranteeing fellowships in terms of match and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think that applicants at the residency stage should be, who really want to pursue, you know, physician scientist careers, should be looking to most likely end up at a program where they could stay beyond the defined residency years, in other words, not move again in 3 years. And so we, just as an example of what we do at the WashU program, we ask our applicants before they come what fellowships they might be thinking of. Some people have, you know, a very clear idea of what they want to do for fellowship already. Some people don't, and that's totally fine. But we definitely have them meet the relevant fellowship directors and during their interview process and talk about those opportunities, and so we can get those applicants in front of those fellowship directors early. And then what we tell people in terms of the opportunity to stay for fellowship is that, you know, it's highly likely that they're going to have that opportunity, presuming that they do satisfactory work in the residency component. We refrain from using the word guaranteed. We call it preferential access to the fellowships here, because I don't think we're allowed to say that people are guaranteed. And there would be some cases in which you, depending on the size of your fellowship programs in popular subspecialties, you might not be able to, quote, mm-hmm. guarantee, if you will, a fellowship slot for everybody in your PSTP. And the probably the place that comes up the most, in my experience, is in pediatric hematology oncology. There are a lot of MD PhDs that want to do pediatric oncology, and, you know, we want to attract those people to our residency program, even if we can't say for sure that we could accommodate every single one of those, just numbers-wise, in our oncology fellowship.
Yeah, this is, I agree with that completely. This is Will from Baylor. So we, given that at this point, as people are considering these type of programs, their perspective and focus needs to be not just on the next 3 years of residency, but by the nature of the kind of strategy here for fellowship and beyond as well. I don't think it makes any sense to be considering residency programs in isolation from some contact and interaction with relevant fellowship programs. Obviously, there might be scenarios in which undifferentiated trainees, you know, change their mind or decide what to do. But either in the first visit, when we have folks come in and do both the categorical residency interview day and then our kind of physician scientist residency interview day, we try to tailor those experiences to the specific interests of the fellows. Obviously, that gets complicated when you're trying to match up, you know, clinical interests, research interests, general physician scientist kind of folks that you'd want them to meet with. But over the course of that visit and then others, the idea is to try and get them experienced with all of those. And it's also important, obviously, from the program perspective, in that if we're bringing in folks who have an interest in a particular fellowship, we don't want to be 2 years down the road and then find out that that fellowship program is not actually interested in this applicant. Obviously, they should be interested if they're you know, they're good applicants. But part of the, I mean, in the best case scenario here for the IRP or any of these other strategies, the residency program as well as the subspecialty and research folks are engaged in mentoring of the trainee from the beginning, not kind of in a staged process.
I agree with what David, this is Fernando, what David and Will say, said, and we approach it the same way. The one thing I wanted to add is, you know, because I didn't bring this up before, we have a separate, in addition to our categorical interview, and we don't have a separate match, but we do have for the physician scientist applicants, we have an extra day that's before their categorical interview day. And it's really focused on that, the things that Will and David mentioned, you know, meeting the fellowship directors, possible research mentors, really to get a sense of both the research environment, but then specifically if they have a stated subspecialty interest, interacting with those people. And that's our way of, you know, getting the fellowship people to meet them to meet the fellowship people. And of course, there's no guarantee or anything like that, but then they have the most information. And then also our fellowship division leaders can provide their input and evaluation on those applicants.
Yep, we do the same thing at WashU with a second day that follows the categorical day, but essentially accomplishes the exact same thing. So that, and if people don't know what fellowship they want to do, or they're thinking of, they have two or three fellowships potentially on their list, you know, we try to get them with a fellowship director or two, But nobody is asking a resident to totally lock in at that stage and say, I promise to do this fellowship. So people can always come to residency and do more thinking about it, get some clinical exposure to those subspecialties early in the intern year, and then narrow down their fellowship choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, we make it very clear that the residents, of course, can change their minds about what they want to do. They can change institutions. They can change plans for fellowship. But that the best case scenario for any of these kind of residency fellowship training programs that involve research is to have it, at least ideally, have the potential to do it at one institution. And that's, I think, how applicants should be thinking about it.
Great. I'm fusing now two different questions, but they're both related to the topic of trainee preparation and the trainee point of view. So what are some features that you would recommend trainees factor when looking at different pediatrician scientist training programs? Related to that, should trainees be choosing programs based on laboratories they might be interested in doing research in, or is it best to look at other factors and find a match in a laboratory later on?
I'll start and then the others can add on. I think that's a great question. I think what makes this a bit of a complex process is I think all of these factors need to be considered. You know, the clinical plans, you know, being someplace you can get excellent clinical residency training, because first and foremost, obviously, that's the point of residency. Where there would be an opportunity to do fellowship training and I get clinical training in the area that you're interested in, that not that necessarily a specific lab needs to be picked, but that there's a rich enough research environment and a number of opportunities that one could, you know, imagine a plan whereby that could work and that a mentor could be found. Really, our goal is not so much to try to match up people with their civic mentor right off the bat, but at least show them, give them some experience of what the environment would be like. And then, in my experience, giving the trainee at least some example of a potential mentor, a potential path that they think of that could be a realistic option. So I think, broadly speaking, the research and the environment needs to be considered from the start, because frankly, for a pediatrician scientist, in many cases, that's the more complicated part of the equation, given that there are a larger number, at least in my opinion, of places one could get excellent clinical training.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. I would double down on that notion of finding yourself on a campus with a depth and breadth of opportunities, and also just that would allow flexibility, because if you didn't have a PhD, it would be welcome to pediatrics as an intern, spend the next 2 or 3 years seeing what excites you most, and you'll have time to tell us what you're going to do next. And for some reason, there's this temptation when you have a PhD to think that somehow predefines the next 10-year sequence of events. And it's a little bit unfair. What it really does is it demonstrates that you have a demonstrated interest in and passion for research, and that you've done it successfully. And I think you wanna, you know, where possible, build in efficiencies by recognizing where you're heading once it becomes clear to you. But don't get too caught up in having to decide way in advance. There's lots of time, and I think you wanna find yourself in a program that will support your course corrections as you sort of find what really speaks to you.
Yep, this is David, and I'll echo those things and add a couple of more to get to the other part of Abhik's question. So, yeah, you want to be in a place where you're not limited in terms of who you might think about. So not, for example, at a place where you're sort of expected later as a fellow to be working in a lab that's within the Department of Pediatrics, for example, but that you essentially have a whole campus playground to look at. And yeah, you definitely don't want to go to a place that, you know, because I want to work with this person, because that person might get recruited away or have something happen in their life where they have to make a job change. And so you definitely want a critical mass of people, potential mentors and researchers in a general area of research that you think you might want to be into. The other things that I tell applicants when they're here to specifically ask about at programs that they're interviewing at. In addition to that research flexibility piece that we just talked about, if an applicant is potentially interested in one of the fast-tracking type pathways, like accelerated research pathway or the IRP, one should ask at programs, like, not only do those programs support that happening, but how many trainees do they currently have who are doing it? So, you know, even a difference between do you do more ARP or IRP people might be important. And you may be at a program where they'll say, yes, we'll do an accelerated research program if you want. And maybe they haven't actually had anybody do that in the last little while. So you want to just know how experienced the program is at having these resident slash fellow trainees on accelerated pathways, what the volume is of people who are following those ABP-defined pathways. Just as an example, at WashU, since we formalized our PSTP 8 years ago, half of our PSTP trainees have decided to fast track and half have not. And that gets back to, I think it was Mike's earlier comment, that we're not telling people they have to fast track or not, but if you're thinking of it as an applicant, you want to go to a place that has some experience with fast tracking. The last thing that I would say in response to that question is, even as an MD PhD, you know, the amount of time that you will spend ultimately in your mentor's lab or research group later as a fellow, et cetera, is likely to be 4 years. That's the median. Might happen sooner, but it might not, and it most often doesn't. And so what that means is, by the end of a traditional fellowship period, year six of a combined program, if you will, you aren't necessarily at that stage ready to launch on your own. You don't necessarily have a K award in hand, for example, at the end of that. And so a question for programs, if you're an applicant and you're looking at these things, is, you know, how does the department or the program support people who are, you know, typically remaining in labs past that? So are they, do they use an instructor title? How are those funded? Does the department support people to stay in the lab and have continued protected research time? How does the program deal with that? Because the way that, you know, science training is now, even if you have a PhD, you're likely to need time past the formal end of fellowship training to continue your research and to be able to get, for example, a K grant or similar career development type grant funded.
This is Fernando again. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That last statement is, that's probably a pretty critical question for people that are applying for residency and planning likely to stay for fellowships. What happens after fellowship during that transition, and how the department or the specific division support you? And because that's really a critical time for everybody's development. You know, what are you going to do when you're waiting for your K, or, you know, you're resubmitting, and are you going to have protected time? How does the funding work, et cetera? Are there internal mechanisms to support you? The other thing I wanted to add is just, and I agree with everything that everybody else said, was just looking specifically at what is the success of previous trainings and getting how many K awards, how many of those people then transition to R01s in the department, just even looking at that history, because it isn't just having a bunch of successful researchers at your institution, but really successful mentors. And really, the mentorship is the most critical part of this stage of a trainee's development. So do they have success in mentoring people to get their Ks and then eventually transition to independence? And that's the other thing I tell people, even at this early stage, that they need to look for in an institution.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. So just for the applicants that are on the call, you know, K success rates, you know, depending on what area of research you're in and what institute within the NIH you might be writing a K application for, you know, success rates might be in the nominal range of 50%, maybe higher, maybe 60 if you're lucky. So you want to ask at the institutions that you're at, what's your historical K success rate? And then the K to R success rate data are pretty well defined as well. So among successful K holders, the K to R success rate is approximately 35% overall for plain MDs, if you will, and 43% for K holders that have MD-PhDs. So again, those are your reference points, and you want to ask at the institutions that you're at, what's your historical K to R success rate? Because for you guys, for MD-PhDs who might be on the line, 43% is the sort of NIH overall average for that transition.
Yeah, I think that's all very true. I think the reassuring message that I would share is that at the end of the day, it's always going to be that the single largest contributor to your future success is going to be you, the trainee, which is reassuring because you control that. How good are your ideas? How hard do you work? How well do you take advice? All the things that you've presumably been doing so successfully. But very close behind that is going to be the resources that get invested in you, be they called mentoring or K preparedness or having a network of scientists to bounce ideas off of and learn from in sort of a vertical and horizontal peer mentoring network. All those things are going to be really important. The metrics about K's and R's are really important, but the harder part to really navigate when you're visiting a campus for a day or two is the sense of commitment, because it's easy to say we're committed, but it's not always easy to see what that commitment looks like. So, try to get a sense while you're on different campuses, you know, how much do they value the physician scientist contributions within their department? What types of what does it sound like they think their responsibility to training you is? If it's, if you get a K during fellowship, we'd love to keep you. To me, that's all well and good, but it doesn't demonstrate a huge investment on their part. I mean, when you recruit somebody to your campus as a physician scientist, ideally what you're telling them is, I'm going to invest in you, and it's going to take a protracted investment through your residency, your fellowship, and your instructor period, because I see great potential in you, and we'd love to see you sort of be on the right trajectory towards the faculty positions and independent careers you want. That's all a lot harder to gather in a day or two, but that to me is the essence that you're trying to extract from your visits. And the metrics, the K's and the R's and the numbers are all going to be useful, but there's also going to be some sort of gut feel about that goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, so related to the previous discussion about different metrics, two questions that are very related to each other that we wanted to ask were, one, what are some ongoing best practices for preparing trainees for the K Award? And related to training post-fellowship, do trainees typically complete a formal postdoc before applying to K Awards and research independence?
So this is Will from Baylor. So I think there's probably a lot of similar strategies and approaches in terms of the practices for preparing trainees. In our program, for example, at Baylor, the second year kind of protected time that we have is spent essentially preparing the trainees to write a mock A grant, which they propose research that then they're going to pursue during their third year, understanding that that's a shorter time, obviously, than for a K, and so there's some mismatch there, but that basically they get taught and go through the process themselves of writing each part of a K, from career development plans to the games pages to how you do a bio sketch and all this sort of stuff. So it's a pretty formal curriculum because it's hands-on curriculum, in that it's something that basically we all just need to learn by example and by having some people show us how it's done. And then there's, formal grant reviews of those grants, like a mock case study section in which they attend with our faculty who are experienced in such things and actually get real-time feedback. So that's here at Baylor, kind of the preparation for the K or similar award is a kind of formal part of the curriculum. The timing for it, I think, is for when one applies for a K is very dependent on the type of research, the kind of career plans for there or whatnot, but I would not generally think, at least for our folks, that a formal postdoc be done, if you mean by that something in addition to the research time that gets done during the clinical fellowship. Typically, these folks, the idea would be that they're in a position that once they get into the lab during fellowship, that they're in a position that they could work on their K and hopefully get that funded.
And this is Sally Permar, and I joined recently, but I just wanted to bring it up if it hasn't been brought up before, is the National Pediatric Scientist Development mm-hmm. Program, which is a national K-12 program across all subspecialties of pediatrics that you apply to as an incoming pediatric subspecialty fellow. And so that program is unique in that it offers 3 years of funding. So starting your second year, or you have two research years within the fellowship training, and then really works with your department to fund a third year that is really your first junior faculty year after the completion of training. And that's a huge advantage to have an additional year that's set aside and protected for research time, where you won't have to take an all clinical job sort of right out of fellowship to be able to continue to develop your research program, have those key first author papers submitted, and then be K award ready is the goal at the end of that, and we have a lot of support to help get you there. So that's an example of a program that's across institutions that supports an additional year in order to really help you solidify your research.
This is David. So once again, at specific institutions that applicants would go to, once again, you want to ask about those out years that we're talking about past the quote formal end of a fellowship and how research time gets protected. The other thing that I guess wanted to tack on, because I think lots of institutions that people might be looking at will have various forms of K writing, mentoring, and example, like repositories of successful Ks, and part of it depends just on the actual mentors that you have at your institution that can show you how it's done. And there's mock study sections and whatnot. The other resources I wanted to point out, and this is with one of my other hats on, so I serve as strategy and operations officer for the Society for Pediatric Research, and one of our main pushes is to, or parts of our mission is to support the development of pediatric scientists. And we do a number of things, some online, but also throughout the year and at our big meeting in April or May, which is called the Pediatric Academic Society's meeting. And we have various programming there, which includes various career developments, K writing. We have a grant writing club that's currently overseen by Carl Bates, who's the chief of pediatric nephrology at Pittsburgh, that we and young investigator coaching program and other programs that can help with some of the things that are being talked about here as well.
I wanted to take this opportunity to also ask about, I'm really appreciative that Dr. Permar raised the or introduce the Pediatric Scientist Development Program in the National K-12. I wanted to kind of ask about, or ask Dr. Permar and Ms. Cooley to kind of comment about additional opportunities for support in the overall structure of the Pediatric Scientist Development Program for trainees. When should individuals look at these opportunities, and how should they integrate them and integrate them into their applications, for example, for fellowships? Or is fellowship too late or too early to even consider these options?
Mm-hmm. Great. Yes, thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about it, because it is you have to be on top of things when you come into a pediatric residency to make sure you're not missing any of these opportunities. I took over as director of the program earlier this year, but it is a program that has been going for 30 years. It was developed by the pediatric department chairs across the U.S. through their society, and has been funded through the National Institute of Child Health and Development for about 25 of those years. So, and we have other funding that comes from other foundations like the March of Dimes, the American Academy of Pediatrics. So it's really a national multi institute supported program. And but in the standard pathway, in which you're going into a fellowship training that is only mainly 1 year of clinical rotations. So that would be sort of all your non-ICU based fellowships. You actually do apply as a resident. And that's because we aim to fund you sort of about 14 months later as a, mainly research focused fellow at that point, greater than 90% of your time being research focused. So you do apply as a third year resident, and that I think can sneak up on people who are not looking out for the program. And I'll let Michelle talk about how to apply and how to engage with us. But one other piece is if you are going into one of the fellowships that is an ICU based fellowship that has longer than 12 months of clinical rotation, then you do actually apply as a first year fellow. And so basically how you can figure it out, besides emailing one of us, which a lot of people do, is to, you will be applying basically 14 months ahead of the time that you will have dedicated research time in your fellowship. Because basically we go through a process to screen the application starting, they're due in beginning of March, so that you know where you're matching if you're going into fellowship that year. So they're due in March. We review all the applications, have interviews at the Pediatric Academic Society meeting, which is at the beginning of May that David was just talking about, and then make decisions in the month of May so that you know, 2 months ahead of time of even joining your fellowship that you're going to be in this program. And then we incorporate you into the program even during your first year, your clinical year of fellowship. And so maybe I'll turn over to Michelle to have her talk about sort of how to apply and complete the eligibility form, which tells you, if you're in the right year of applying, and then how to connect with us on social media, et cetera, so you can know the opportunities. Michelle, are you on?
Might be muted, if so.
Okay. If not, I can fill in. So let me just fill in that we do have an eligibility form that can be found on our website. So if you just type in PSDP, we will come up on a website. The website is housed under the AMSPDEC, which is the American Medical School Department Chairs of Pediatrics. That's the parent organization of PSDP. But if you just type in PSDP, our website comes up, and there is an eligibility form that you complete in order to make sure that you're in the right year for applying. And that can be submitted really any time, but we want it submitted by February 1st. So it'll be February 1st of your third year in pediatric residency, or if you're going into an ICU-based specialty, then it's typically in your first year of fellowship. Now, we are newly trying to connect more through social media, so please follow us on Twitter. It's at PSDP underscore AMSPDEC. Connect with us via email. We can also, give you any of those links that if you haven't been able to find them.
Great. Thank you very much. That's really, really, really helpful. Transitioning to another question we received from the chat room related to funding. So this is a question for all of the panelists. How are PEDS, PSDP residents and fellows financially supported relative to general PEDS residents? Where exactly does the funding come from, and how does it compare to general PEDS residency programs?
So this is David. I'll jump in with at least my thoughts on this. So my guess, my supposition is that the question of where the money comes from, if you will, is probably, the answer is probably different at almost any institution you would go to, because the financial models of, departments of pediatrics and children's hospitals, those models are slightly different at every place, and the sources of funding that an institution might choose to use for supporting their PSTP might be different. So, that I would say that level of detail might might not need to be totally visible to an applicant in terms of where the institution is getting the money. But really, once again, they want to know, A, if their clinical time is going to be constrained and compartmentalized so that they can have time to do research. And then some programs would offer some discretionary money for spending, in other words, to go to meetings, buy computers or other types of supplies. And then some programs would have salary supplements that would be given to people in the PSTP, perhaps in the fellowship phase, but that would be variable, I think, across programs.
This is Sally. And,
Go ahead.
I'll just talk from the Duke perspective because I'm also representing that. So one opportunity that we have, and a couple of different institutions in pediatrics, I think Vanderbilt and Nationwide, is an R38 program, which is stimulating access to research during residency. NIH's attempt to really formalize research training during residency. And so we have that opportunity available to pediatric residents. And it's actually allowed us to set aside two slots for pediatric residents who want to focus on research integration during residency. And then once you come, you do apply to the R38 program. If you're on one of those tracks, you are, a prime candidate. And so the R38 programs are across multiple departments. So our R38 program are across Department of Peds, Medicine, Surgery. Actually, we're getting new programs in Radiation Oncology, Radiology, and Neurology, Psychiatry, and Family Medicine. So we actually have a lot of our departments will now have R38. And this, what it does is it funds the sort of just over half of your salary during your research time, which is 18 months. In our pediatric program, it's you would expand your residency to 4 years. But you would have 18 months of research built in, and then you can fulfill all your board requirements with that 4 years, and have the option to potentially shorten your fellowship if your research is far enough along. So it can fit all into the 6 year window of training. But in addition to funding the majority of your salary during your research time, it also gives you funding for research, so $20,000 of research funds. And about $5,000 of travel and conference funding. And so our applicants find that nice to use as a way to sort of develop a program that may be sort of outside of what their mentor is already doing. So programs that have R38 fellowships is something to look for. These are very new fellowships, and they were awarded starting in 2017. The NIH has not even decided to renew them yet. So they are sort of, at this point, short-lived. But at least programs that, are actively applying for these sorts of things will be, very focused on physician scientists.
I think that's a good model to bring up. This is Mike Hogarty from CHOP Penn. We have an R38 as well. Our model's a little bit different. What Sally was describing is kind of a hybrid, a sort of like a plus one four-year program with research, but then there is some additional research in the 3 years that otherwise would have been categorical. Here we have two options. We have an IRP-like option where you still do a three-year residency. You essentially do what looks like an IRP, except your research is supported and has all the bells and whistles of the R38. And the only thing I really wanted to tag on to the prior comment is that even though we're not sure where this is going in terms of renewal and ongoing investment, it does seem like a program that if it succeeds, would get reinvested. And I believe they're rolling out K-38s that would be open only to trainees who had been on the R-38. So the R-38 would have been an institutional slot you were provided, but the K-38 would be an individual grant. Details to be determined, but there's some extra perks of that pathway for reasons of access to other grant opportunities.
Yeah, and that's actually out now, the K-38, if you want to look at that opportunity as well. It's available now.
I actually wanted to jump on as a follow-up question to that from the chat room. Is the R-38 only a PSTP trainee funding opportunity, or can any resident wanting to do research, for example, late bloomers or individuals who get into research later, can they also apply for R38s internally?
It's any, and in fact, if you read the fine print, it's almost geared more towards late bloomers. It's trying to increase the pipeline of people that see research as a viable component of their future career. That said, it does not exclude MD PhDs, and we've had both non-MD PhDs and PhD holding pediatric trainees on our R38. So it's pretty wide open. What you're really trying to do is demonstrate that you are increasing the probability that somebody goes on to contribute in the research arena through this mm-hmm. mechanism.
Thank you.
Yeah, also I do okay. We'll take from the categorical as well as research track position.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Another question that was raised in the chat was regarding just the overall, just this is more of a meta question. What are some of the benefits of doing a formal PSTP over a traditional categorical residency? In this person states examples where PIs have explained that they might have achieved the same thing through a traditional research residency path or through a traditional residency pathway versus a integrated pathway. So they wanted to get your comments regarding what are some advantages over formalized PSTPs.
Right. So this is Will. I guess I can start. I mean, at part it's just that there's different models for the amount of protected research time within each of those training programs, as well as different about the amount and kind of location in terms of where you are within the training residency to fellowship experience of that model. And then most importantly, kind of what mentorship is provided to guide people through those various transitions, right? So and with the integrated research pathway as we usually follow here at Baylor, there's a year of protected research time essentially in total during residency. And the whole strategy is devised around, kind of starting the integrated physician scientist life that trainees and folks will be living from here on out, and trying to get as quickly as possible to truly working to integrate these experiences into kind of one career. So there's all sorts of different models for that. And, for example, say a straight categorical residency program with a little bit of research worked in is just less research time. It isn't necessarily a model which one couldn't use to go on to become a physician scientist, but it would just be, very different in terms of the amount of protected time to do this sort of thing.
Okay. On that note, another question is, how do we... even more upstream, how do we even apply to your programs? Is there a consolidated way of looking at which pathway to apply to on ARIS? Or what would you recommend trainees do to even become familiar with what options are available?
So for Baylor, for example, through ARIS, one would just look and see the various, the straight categorical residency program as well as the various kind of pediatric variant programs, including the physician scientist training program. So it'd be straightforward to find.
This is David at WashU. So going back to a comment I think that was made earlier, there's going to be a little bit of variability in how things show up in ARIS. So some institutions, as was just stated a moment ago, will have separate ARIS sort of listings, program designations within the match. Other institutions, WashU does it this way. We have one program in ARIS, one categorical listing, and so all of our applicants list that on their match lists. A couple of related comments. One is that Abhik and a few of us others have been talking separately through SPR, et cetera, about how to generate a up-to-date sort of web-based list of all of the PSTPs that one might consider, and to allow program to have a clearinghouse where programs could centrally list some of the key features of or types of programs, you know, IRPs, ARPs, R38s, et cetera, that they have. So I think there's work to be done there, you know, that would do a little bit better for applicants in versus just Googling, you know, pediatric physician scientist training program and seeing what comes up. So we're working on that, and there's more work to do. Avik, I'll get back to you on that. And so that's the stage, I think, that I think we can, you know, hopefully have some more tools out there for applicants to use to figure out what institutions even have formalized PSDPs in pediatrics and, you know, in general, what those might look like. And then, of course, link out to individual institutional websites, which, of course, we'll have lots more detail on whatever the programs are at various institutions.
Thank you. A question that we've received from the chat room is regarding how early should applicants consider these programs? More specifically, do you recommend trainees do a campus visit even before the interview process? For example, at the end of your PhD, if you're in a formal MD-PhD program, as you're beginning to start and explore options and locations?
This is Will. I mean, that sounds fantastic in an ideal circumstance, but I would not think for many people would be that feasible, particularly if you're looking at considering a number of different institutions. So I would not think of that being in any way required. Of course, any information you can get, especially about, you know, the environment, the city you're thinking about, and that sort of thing is always very helpful.
Yeah, this is David. I would totally agree. I wouldn't say that a visit at that stage would be required, expected, or anticipated. I think reaching out to, you know, if you do some online research and there's places you're thinking about and et cetera, reaching out to PSTP directors by email, even at the I just finished my PhD stage, you know, these directors would be happy to exchange information by email or to have a phone call or Skype or whatever it is to give you the information that you need, but I don't think you need to start traveling to different places at that stage because you're going to do it at the interview stage later.
I agree with both those points. No need to invest the time and resources, but I would endorse the idea of if you don't have to do it widely and broadly, but if you have a couple of places you're more inclined to think would be a good fit, reaching out to the physician scientist program director, if there's one identified, or even the residency program director to be guided to the right contact, never hurts. And, you know, you could just share some information and, you know, all of us are happy to exchange email information or get on the phone sort of to just update you on our philosophy of training physician scientists.
And this, I was just going to add one thing is, so you want to use, you probably already talked about this, but you want to use your residency interview as a, you're actually interviewing mentors, potential mentors, right? So doing the work to figure out who you want to interview with as potential mentors and even potentially networking with mentors ahead of time, potential mentors. So I think that is the legwork to do instead of actually traveling anywhere.
Mm-hmm. This is a question related to trainees currently in programs. Since trainees, or I think it's been acknowledged that the training period for research integrated careers is getting longer, and since trainees are reaching increasing ages prior to matriculation into residency programs and PSDP or PST programs, what policies are there currently to support trainees beginning or continuing support of their families during this process, and is subsidized childcare and housing available?
You're talking about different than might be available for other categorical pediatric residents?
This would be specifically both for general residents and fellows within categorical residencies, as well as if there are any additional resources that are available or tailored towards individuals and PSDPs.
This is Fernando, UCSF. We don't have anything specific for the physician scientists. We do, obviously, cost of living is a big issue here in San Francisco. We have a housing stipend for all that goes across UCSF, across all the residents, for all the PGYs. I think $12,000 a year. And then we do have subsidized housing, and we're building more, but there there isn't enough for everybody. So it's kind of a lottery system where we are opening a significant amount. But those are the two things we do for specifically for those kind of financial cost of living issues. But like I said, that's across the residents, not specific to the physician scientist trainees.
And this is Sally. So at Duke, we do have a fund available through the Dorth Duke Clinical Foundation, which supports basically increased care needs for physician scientists. It's really, I'd have to check the eligibility, but it may only be at the junior faculty level. But that's sort of first foray into, you know, if you have a change in your home requirements for care provision, then you can apply to a fund to, it basically will fund like a technician or statistical support, something that, you know, you can involve someone else to facilitate you sort of finishing a project. So that's an opportunity.
Yep. This is David at WashU, and I think that's a good point. We have a similar Dorth Duke program here, but I think, Abhik, what you're getting at, these kinds of features are more likely to be more general, not specific sort of add-ons for a PSTP, but for, you know, are there for a residency program and are there for research trainees across an institution. So, you know, these are still good questions for applicants to ask, like, and hopefully their interview experience will include some interaction with actual trainees that are currently in the PSTP where they can ask questions like, hey, you know, what kind of childcare is available? And, you know, for example, here there are multiple childcare centers on the campus. They have extended hours that you can get, et cetera, et cetera. But none of that is sort of, quote, specific to the PSTP. Mm-hmm. It's just this is a WashU institutional sort of backbone piece.
Right. Here at Baylor, it's the same story. There are not specific resources of that sort from the PSP.
Thank you. A question from the chat. How common is it for PSTP trainees to stay on at their respective institutions and join faculty? Cornell, for example, has a formalized program for residents to assume faculty positions straight out of residency and fellowship.
So this is Will from Baylor. So there's going to be institutional differences in the details of that, but in essence, I think the thing to remember for trainees is that a successful MD-PhD and then physician scientist trainee should be a very sought after commodity in terms of faculty positions. So for example, here at Baylor, I also play a role in leading our hematology oncology program. And there's nothing we would like better than to have future faculty members who are trainees coming up through this pathway. So we don't have a formalized program where that's guaranteed in any way, but we do our best to make it clear to the trainees that that pathway exists and shows the resources for both mentoring across that entire timeline as well as, you know, support in terms of grant support and other options for support, both institutional and otherwise during those years. So I think you'll get slightly different answers in terms of how that's described, but I think in general, the enthusiasm should be pretty universal.
Yep, this is David. I would agree. Most institutions will want most of these people as potential faculty members, and one of the driving factors for most institutions to have and support these programs is in part to, you know, have a pipeline for those faculty to join at, you know, at their home institutions. I would say, you know, just as a, you know, there's nothing that says a person in these programs is signing in blood that they're gonna stay as a faculty member. And we certainly encourage our graduating people to look around, even if we strongly want them to stay as long-term faculty members, because I think that's just a good experience and it helps build their network and see how other institutions do it. There's no magic formula. So we encourage people to get out there and look, but yeah, I think we, like most programs, would love to see many of these people stay on as our long-term investigative faculty.
I agree completely. I also am apologizing. I have to get off the call, so I've enjoyed it. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for joining. One comment that was made earlier, or several times, was mentorship and the importance of mentorship for successful physician scientist training careers. So one question that we wanted to ask were, how are your programs developing a culture of mentorship? What are some programmatic features and best practices amongst different research and residency or PSDPs to build that network of successful pediatrician scientist trainees and investigators?
So this is Will. There are a number of ways I think this is built in these programs, including ours at Baylor. And one, the general one is, I think, was referred to way at the beginning of the call, when there's a point made about, like, one of the real motivating features of these programs was to create a community of physician scientists, so not just at the residency level, fellowship level, faculty level, and have opportunities for, you know, mentorship, both informal and formal, between all those different folks across different specialties, and to really create at each institution a culture where that's the expectation and, you know, a big part of the draw of being there. More formally, you know, different institutions will have different plans for this as part of their program. You know, ours, for example, during residency, you know, from the start, assigns a series of different mentors and a mentorship committee, some of whom are their specific research mentors, some are more clinical mentors, others who are kind of just playing a role of a more, you know, senior advisor and consigliere, so to speak. And so there are a number of different ways in which that's worked into the structure of these programs. But I think this is, you know, the absolutely crucial feature, because I, again, alluding to something that was mentioned before, part of what's really needed here is a group of mentors and people that are looking out for the trainee, both from the residency and fellowship and broader institutional perspectives, such that if plans change, if problems or challenges arise, or, you know, folks get diverted in one way or another, that they have a group of people who are there to ready to help them strategize that and make an alternative plan. If everything goes smoothly and great in terms of, you know, you pick a great place, you do a good job in clinic, you find first shot a mentor who's doing exactly what you want to do, and you stick with that, then, you know, there's not such a diversity of mentors. Maybe they're crucial at all times there, but for folks who are more typical and have spend some time figuring this all out and meeting a few obstacles and challenges along the way, it's really important to both have these kind of formal mentorship structures, not just in terms of the leadership of the PSDPs, but also, you know, other committees and other mentors, including their lab mentor, but then also a more, you know, a culture environment where if they have questions about things, they also have a number of their, you know, fellow trainees and past trainees at different years that they can also consult with.
And this is Sally. I'll just add that we also have identified mentors both within the Department of Pediatrics and outside who are either great mentors and or really good career mentors. And so we call them our master mentor pool. And we actually have an Office of Physician Sciences Development that goes across the entire university that I lead as the Associate Dean of Physician Sciences Development. And one of the major goals of that office is to connect trainees who are interested in a research career across departments and even across schools, you know, to the engineering school, whatever, you know, may be something that you're interested in connecting with. So being able to utilize a program that's specific around finding you the right mentors. The other thing we put in place is two things. One is a program manager who's a PhD level individual who is on staff basically to support the PSDP program in pediatrics. And her goal, Dr. Katie Barrett is our identified person. Her goal is really to take you through the process as a new trainee coming to our PSDP program of identifying your mentor, any co-mentor needs, and a scholarship oversight committee as a resident that you will then meet with every 6 months. And that, I think, is a major way to formalize basically what Will just said, that you need mentors, not just, you know, your direct research mentor, but across different spectrums and pieces of your career. And so, and then by formalizing these meetings, you basically, you know, have to address your progress and where you're going every 6 months with a group of people who really care about you getting to the career that you want. So I think those interventions have made a big difference for our residents who are trying to accomplish some research during residency.
Thank you. Going back to an earlier question about recommendations for specific factors for trainees to look at when interviewing at different programs, we wanted to flip the question. What are some features that you're looking at when interviewing applicants?
This is David at WashU. So probably there's some institutional variability there in terms of what's prioritized, but I'll just speak to a couple of general concepts. So obviously the application packet, which looks like a residency application packet, you know, there are a few important pieces in there. I would say for me personally, and this might not be the case at every place, I would say productivity during the PhD period. Obviously recognizing that there are many, many different types of research and, you know, there may, it's not just like how many papers did you have, it's more complicated than that, but just looking at what the body of work was and also reading the letter. The letters of support are really important, but, you know, what the PhD mentor's letter of recommendation says, I think is really important. And that's not only this person got this done in the lab, but this is what this person's approach is and how it suits them to a long-term career in science. Those are things that we look at. Obviously, things like med school grades and scores are there, like test scores and whatnot. But I think, you know, and then the personal statement is important in terms of people, the applicant being able to express, you know, to a degree that they can at that early stage. Once again, they're not expected to know 20 years from now, this is exactly what I want to be doing, or even this is the kind of fellowship I want to do. But just being able to express in the personal statement a commitment to a science-focused, you know, physician scientist career.
This is Will from Baylor. I agree with all that. I mean, fundamentally, we're looking for people who, number one, we think will be good pediatric trainees and good pediatricians and a valued part of the clinical community in their time here. So that's kind of first and foremost. But then secondarily, we're looking for folks who have done some interesting research, have some, you know, have some ideas about what they'd like to do in the future, and that we think we could help mentor along that pathway. And so obviously, there's at any of these big institutions, there are a variety of researchers there, but making sure it's someone who that we think there could be a match at the fellowship program level and in the research lab level is one of the factors we take into consideration as well.
And this is Sally from Duke. I'm just going to emphasize two things. So one is the clinical performance, because that becomes very important to, you know, our general residency program director admissions process, and then also that we're trying to guarantee our research track residents can be admitted into our fellowship programs without having to go through the match. And so if they want to know that you're an excellent clinical or clinician from the outset. So those clinical scores, et cetera, are very important. And then secondly, doing your homework. So knowing like what potential mentors are at Duke that you would want to interact with, you know, on your interview, and, you know, thinking about what would be realistic for, you know, working with some of the potential mentors, so that those two things, I think, make people stand out.
Great. Independent, probably the last question given the time for the conference call, but as kind of a last question, then opening it up to a broader discussion if there's time. Independent of protected research time and interactions with mentors, what are some ongoing best practices for integrating research and scientific rigor during the clinical training period?
So this is Sally. I can start with, and metrics, I guess, are you thinking of how applicants would be metricing potential residencies or PSDP programs?
Oh, no. My question was related to completely independent of interacting with their research mentor and the time protected for research in either a wet lab or whatnot. What are some other programmatic features of research integrated residency programs or PSCPs that promote integrating research within the entire clinical training period? For example, like journal clubs, et cetera.
Okay. Mm-hmm. One thing that I just, coming from the aspect of evaluating potential residencies and PSDP programs, is looking for whether within the leadership of the residency there is physician scientist representatives, because the trickle down all comes from there. So whether you're going to have set aside time for journal club means like somebody at the leadership level of your residency needs to be making sure that that's seen as important. So that I think is just starting from the top down. But yeah, I think cohorting with other residents or fellows, even junior faculty who are interested in a research career is important. And so that may mean journal club, that may mean professional development, seminar series, opportunities to attend conferences within the department where you can showcase your work. How many people are going to the Pediatric Academic Society meetings every year? So yeah, I think you want scientific content in your residency, and you want it at a group level so that, you know, you don't feel like you're alone in the world trying to be a pediatrician scientist.
I think those are all good points. I mean, part of what we do in trying to create this community is to have it be one that engages people no matter what kind of step in the pathway they're at. So obviously when you're in clinical training, you have the potentially less flexibility and capacity to participate in particular conferences, dinners, happy hours, social events, you know, lectures, mixers, like that sort of stuff. But we do try as much as possible to engage our trainees, you know, even when they're in the clinic and all of these sort of things, and to try and plan strategically so that we can do that.
Great. At this time, I wanted to thank each of the panelists for participating in this conference call and taking time out of their schedules to interact with us. So thank you very much to Dr. Parsons, Dr. Gonzalez, Dr. Hunstad, Dr. Hogarty, Dr. Permar, and Ms. Michelle Cooley for participating and joining us on the call. For those individuals who have connected via phone, the recording of this GoToMeeting interactive session will be posted on APSA's website for accessibility following. And thank you all very much for your time and consideration today. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday season.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Best regards.